You're listening to The Shot Podcast, presented by Grey Goose Vodka. Whether it's a dinner party for 10 or a small kickback, you know the vibes will always be right if you're surrounded by your favorite people. And great company pairs best with a great cocktail. So make it a Grey Goose Martini cocktail. Impress your guests in style with an espresso martini or the always effortless classic martini with a lemon twist. No matter what you decide, everyone can appreciate the smooth, delicate taste that only a Grey Goose Vodka Martini can provide. For more info on how to craft a vodka-based cocktail, visit greygoose.com and remember to always sip responsibly. Paul Rivera here. We've got a great episode lined up for you guys. Myself and Mav are joined by the legendary LL Cool J.
Everybody's not going to be a fan of everybody. I can't, that ain't my job.
Trent Williams.
You never really know how tough you are till you gotta be.
Lena Waithe.
The second someone picks up on what I'm doing, I'm gonna switch it up.
Teddy Swims.
The gimmick of that I sound this way, but I look this way.
And Mo Gilligan.
I'm a stand-up comic. This is what I do.
Listen now.
I do not believe that shit.
On the weekend.
No way.
Yes.
Because you're a writer. Writers never stop.
That's true.
You always, even in your head, right?
Everything is copy.
Everything.
Everything is copy.
Now, you set time aside to write, or it's just an ongoing?
You have to. Like today, when I have to leave, I have to go to my office and figure out. You see, you get these scripts. You know, you've been had so many great scripts. But it's like, we have to figure out what is every scene, and then I can start writing. Because, like, with The Shy, like, I knew the first scene was going to be a dead body and a young man coming up to it and having a conversation with him.
Oh, so you figure out the scenes and the story arc and everything, lay all of that out,
and then you start writing.
It's like Stallone, like kind of like what Stallone does. Do you say the words out loud so it's on his feet? So that, you know, because sometimes what you do this on.
See, that's the benefit of me having
that's a great point. When you type in what you say, it can be
very different.
But that's the thing. Every writer should take acting classes.
Yeah.
So that way we know, because that's like I've had to act. I've been in front of the camera, so I know what it's like to have to deliver lines.
Yeah.
So what I have to do when I'm writing is like I say it out loud. I want it to be super conversational.
Right.
Like, you know, it's like the reason why we love Any Given Sunday, we can watch it any day of the week.
Right.
Because the conversation, it feels grand and big. It's like you guys are our gladiators. So it's like if you watch Any Given Sunday, watch Gladiator after that. And see the similarities.
Right.
Like, these are the cats that could go into the ring, and we the spectators. What is the difference between a spectator and a peasant?
A lot of times, a writer, you know, if they're not careful, all of the characters can have a similar voice. And sometimes writers, especially the ones that are a little bit more, that err on the more academic side, make everything, like the word is pedantic, or make everything so intricate in that, see, you could be smart and be simple. Sometimes they're smart and complicated, and all characters aren't like that. Some are, but you have to be able to differentiate between them in order to really bring the story to life so that the actors can really embody it. You know what I'm saying?
I know exactly what you're saying,
yeah.
And because smart people sometimes have trouble. To me, that is the highest form of smarts, when you can take something so fucking complicated
and make it simple.
And make it
Through the complexity.
And make everybody
to make it
go,
like X and O's.
Like X and O's.
Getting through the complicated play to the look, hit your spot. This is the spot. This is where you gotta be at this point in the game. Like, that's the discipline of the whole thing.
Yeah.
That's how you win.
Yeah, for sure. Do y'all got that with Kyle? Because he always seemed, everybody said he's like probably the smartest coach in the NFL. And he's got all those fucking sheets, and it looks like what he's doing is very complicated, but to y'all, do we communicate it straightforward and easy to y'all?
Nah, that shit complicated. It's complicated, and the reason why the scripts are so big, because our plays are extremely long. That's why you see the wristband, because it takes too long to call it in to the headset, so you just call a number. Quarterback literally is like reading a book, but...
Is the plays really fucking long?
They are very long, but... The simplicity, too, because it just tells everybody what they're supposed to do.
So that's actually something I want to ask you. In the huddle, what are you listening? What are you, Trent, listening for in the call? Because it's a long call.
Right.
What are you listening for?
Just like a pass play, I'm listening for the protection. He might say three jet, XYZ, 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 I'm leaving the huddle as soon as I hear three jets.
That's your protection.
Yeah, that's my, you know, and it's
what the receivers gotta do with your
business. They don't got nothing to do with me. That's why they don't know the protection. You know what I'm saying? They hear their routes and they gone. Yeah.
And when you break the huddle, everybody obviously knows the quarterback. What are you as a lineman looking for? You break the huddle.
Yeah, we talked to Sauce Gardner and Chet Ocho about, like, as a receiver in corners. And Sauce was like, he don't really even go to the huddle. He come out, he look directly at the receiver's feet, study the guy, try and get a read on what route he gonna run.
Right. So it's when you got a pass protection, there's two sides, right? Because we got five people. So three gotta go one way, two gotta go the other way. The two are the man, what we call man side. So that means I'm mano-a-mano, he mano-a-mano. On that side, they're in what we call a slide. So everybody has the gap over. So if he came off the edge, I'm responsible for him. And my guard got to take mine, and then we pass it down.
Good. I was worried I had him, so I'm glad.
Let Trent take him, B. You get the hell out of the way.
Exactly. So, you know, I mean, for me, if I get a man side, then, yeah, I'm just coming. I'm looking at the DN. I get the snap count. I hear the protection. Now I'm studying him. Now his alignment is going to tell me a lot of what's coming next. And, you know, you see the safety, that the safeties are wandering around over here. That means that they probably replacing somebody that's coming over here. So I got to know that, even if I'm not blocking him, because that's going to change his job. So if I know his job before the play snap, it puts me as an advantage. You know what I'm saying?
Hey, have you been studying him all week?
Been studying him all week.
So you know if he line a little bit this way, a little bit this way, exactly. It's something different.
Yes. Can I ask, you see, as an athlete, how much of it is like technical, where you have to read plays, and how much of it do you feel like is talent?
Or instincts.
Yeah, like, because there must be times where you want to break out and do your own thing, although you have to follow the script.
Right.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, like, the defensive side is a lot off of see ball, get ball. You know, you got concepts, but most of it is all going to revolve around who got the ball, where guys running. The offensive side, it's all about X's and O's and staying within the system, you know, because the wide receiver might feel like he can get a dude a little extra at the top of the route, but that little half a second makes a quarterback hold on to the ball for a half a second. Now that DN is slapping the ball out right as he's throwing it. Mm. You get what I'm saying? So as a wide receiver, you got to be disciplined and know, yeah, I know I can be on Instagram by making this guy fall and we'll have highlights, but what does that do for the rest of the chain link? You know, is that going to help us or is it going to hurt us? And that's what Cal thing is that everything is about timing, everything is about scheme.
But it must be a little bit like that making shows too, or for sure as an actor, like once the whole cast is gelling and rolling, but if you got one or two people off, it fucks up the whole, like I imagine it can fuck up the whole flow.
Yeah, it's so interesting because even like hearing you talk about, like it's almost even using the term scripts, you know what I'm saying, and memorizing, there's so many similarities between, you know, what we're doing. But I actually, it's funny because I often use sports analogies when I'm talking about writing or careers and things like that because it actually kind of fits with each other. Like we are a team. Like when it's like teamsters. Like even like, you know,
Teamwork makes the dream work.
Makes the dream work, you know? And so it's like, but then there are people that are in front. You know, there are people that are behind the scenes and you need everybody to be on the same page. And you're right. I mean, I think, but just like any team, like, you know, you have a veteran who's been on the team for a long time, then you have a rookie that comes in. So that's not unlike on TV shows. Like you'll be on the show for like a bunch of seasons and then they'll add new characters. Because what does it do? It brings in new blood and all that kind of stuff. So that's what we've tried to do, especially on The Chi, is to have like new people every season. Because it keeps the people that have been on the show from day one kind of sort of in not never getting complacent. And so I think that's sort of what it is.
Or jaded.
Jaded. And it's easy to do, you know? It's like whether being in the league or being in the business, because like you spend your whole life trying to get into the game and you finally get in there and you realize, oh, this is not what I thought it was going to be. But it's an amazing life. Like we've led great lives because we were able to tap into this gift that was sort of given to us, but we were able to sacrifice and make sure we didn't take that gift for granted. But in not taking it for granted, there's a lot of sacrifices that come with that.
Do you have to often tell yourself that you're not lucky as well? Because I think for me, being a comic, like you often feel that like you're always, I meet a lot of comics and they say you're only as good as your last show.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes you feel lucky sometimes. You know, if you have a big achievement where, you know, you might have won something or you have something that works well and you think, oh, maybe this happened. But I think it's really important to tell yourself, well, I'm not lucky. I'm not just stumbled upon this. I've worked at the craft.
You can be blessed, you work hard, mm-hmm. you put the energy in, right? Because your attitude determines your altitude. Mm. You know what I'm saying? And a lot of people, you know, in order to be successful for a long time, you can't, it's a few things. One, it means you ain't lazy,
right?
Then the other thing is, you know, you have some people who they're successful, but they're over it. It's like, oh, they just can't wait to get off practice or get out of here. Yeah. Everything's about what I got to do over there. Mm-hmm. But then they, at the same time, they're kicking and screaming against the things that they claim they want with that attitude. Okay. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And that has a lot to do with, like, vets and rookies, because you got some vets that are over it.
Yeah.
And then you have some vets that treat it like they've been rookies forever.
Right. Mm.
Like, you know, that was the thing, like me, when I would see Ray Lewis, like every time I talk to him, I feel like I'm talking to a guy who just started. Yeah. Like every time I talk to him. Yeah. And you know, to me, that is a huge part of long-term success. Like you, like decades, as opposed to like, you know, 10 years and you know, what happened.
Well,
you know what I mean?
You are the poster child for decades of long-term success,
like,
right?
You've reinvented yourself like so many times and had so many different, like I remember In the House. Like, you know what I'm saying? Because I was having dinner with Debbie Allen and I talked to her about that. I was like, that's so, because obviously I love Debbie Allen, obviously that's my North Star. But I remember that show, like you guys living under the same roof and with her kids and all that kind of stuff. And it's just like, but that's just, that's a chapter in a very long, beautiful career.
For sure.
So it's like, so just, can you speak to what it's been like to begin so young?
Yeah.
And people maybe kind of go, is he gonna be a fad? He's gonna still be around. So how are you able to fit into all these spaces and none of it feel weird or odd or foreign?
Well, there's a few things, right? First of all, God is great. You know what I'm saying? I have faith in God and I got faith in myself. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, when we started Def Jam, I was 16.
Right.
You see what I'm saying? So I put my first album out when I was 16.
Nice.
Right? So the thing that you realize is that you're going to make mistakes. So one of the things that I had to learn, because I'm actually an introvert. Like most people wouldn't assume that. Most people would think I'm an extrovert.
No, shut up. I wouldn't assume that.
but I'm an introvert, right? So growing up, when I was first starting, I didn't really know how to go to parties and all that. You know what I'm saying? Mm. Like I ain't really know how to be sociable with people and go play at poker games with people and, you know what I'm saying, be friendly. It wasn't that I wasn't willing to be friendly. It's just that, you know, that's just my nature. Mm. You know what I'm saying? So you learn after a while how to actually embrace people and you realize that you're gonna spend your life looking at different people, and these people that you think you're just passing by are actually the story of your life.
I don't know, what keeps you motivated, passionate about the music after all the success you've had? You have an album coming out,
right?
Yeah,
I got an album coming out.
So, wait, and when was your last one?
It was 1,000 years ago, and it wasn't. it was 1,000 years ago, and I made it in a vacuum, and it really wasn't that impactful. You know, I like the challenge. You know what I'm saying? I think that hip hop hasn't really had a Santana moment. I think that we're so used to things coming and going that we don't even understand the idea of an artist being out for 30, 40 years and making great shit. Like, we don't even think in those terms.
The art form's not old enough to figure
that out. That's what I'm saying. Yes. So we're not used to it, right? So
we don't have a Rolling Stones yet.
Yet, right? So so we're at this place where it's like, I believe personally that, you know, you can make an artistic contribution throughout your career. You just gotta be able to step up and actually do it. Because a lot of people, they talk about it, but then they can't get it done.
Can't
so,
deliver
you know,
on it.
That's why I'm making it, because I just love the challenge. I love the idea.
Have you been thinking about making it for a long time? Or did you just I'm gonna do it?
No, I was thinking about it, and then, you know, actually, the way I came out with my album, I'll give you the real story. The story is I had got with Dre, right? Me and Dre was working in the studio, and we did like 30, 40 songs. You know, but it just wasn't all the way right. His beats were pristine, they were amazing, but I didn't feel like my writing was really up to par. Hmm. So I took a step back, and then I had a dream. Fife Dawg from A Tribe Called Quest, the great legendary group, amazing group, Tribe Called Quest. This the kid, Fife Dawg, he passed away, may he rest in peace. He came to me in a dream. He's like, yo, that music you're making with Dre is gonna be dope. I'm like, really? He's like, yeah, it's gonna. But he had this funny look on his face. And I remember like not understanding the look. So when I woke up, I called Q-Tip. You know what I'm saying? Q-Tip. And I called Q-Tip. I'm like, yo, Tip. He like, what's up? I'm like, I said, yo, let's work. I wanna make an album. He said, well, what kind of album you wanna make? I said, I don't know, I want some hot sauce, barbecue sauce, pickle juice, fucking, you know, I want it as nigga-fied as it possibly can be. Like, I just want the blackest red, black, and green Marcus Garvey-est shit you could ever fucking come up with Nigerian DNA baked in it. I want that shit all the way black, right? And he's like, all right, say less, let's do it. So I went, you know, I went to his crib, and, you know, we ended up working on the album. So now it's complete. And it's,
so he produced the whole album?
Yeah, Q-Tip did my whole album.
What?
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, and it's fun because it's a challenge, right? Because it could go one or two ways. It could either be amazing or it could be 3 days of fire emojis from 10 people. You know what I mean? You know, these dudes be on there, yo, the album is out. You get 3 days of fire emojis, that shit's a wrap. That shit's a risen. That shit's out of here. That shit is over. So it's like, you know, that's the fun part for me. You know?
To your point, I like that part that, like, so I'm 42, so I grew up with, like all of us, with fucking hip hop, but like I'm Bad was the first, we had the record player
a long time
at the
ago.
Bottom of the wicker stand. Every Saturday, my mom would clean up. She'd play a whole, she got a whole album, right. Usually be Anita Baker, Rapture. Right. I got one song. She would get the whole album, probably get one song.
Right.
And my song was I'm Bad, so I've grown up with you, everybody, and like, you know, it's weird, it's not weird, it's interesting to see this moment we're in the hip-hop, because hip-hop has now become the biggest art form in the world, in the music genre. But then you have, like, the people we grew up with, like Nas went on this run where he made, like, six albums or something between, you know, 45 and 50 years old. He made the final one when he was 50. And then Andre put out his version of what he thought and didn't want to rap. And, like, it's like some people feel like rap is in, and hip-hop is this young person's game, and it's not for me if I'm older. And were you at all thinking about that? Or are you like, I'm gonna make
it? I don't even really understand that. I mean, how old was Picasso when he did his greatest work? Like, I don't even know what that shit means. I mean, who came up with that rule?
There is no rule.
Like,
I
agree. No, but I'm just
Rolling Stone's still on tour.
Dude, right? No, like, you're 80. Like, I don't really understand it. It's, you know, there is a difference between art and sports. Sports, there is a physical for limitation sure. on certain things. For it sure. just is what it is. You have freaks of nature like your man who can who can extend it. You know what I'm saying? But even at that, it probably won't do it when he's 50.
For
probably
sure.
could.
I know. He's like, hold on.
But I'm saying, like, it's like, with the arts, it's about, is your mind fluid? Are you, like, or has it been crystallized? You know what I'm saying? Calcified. Like, are you interested in life? You know what I'm saying? What happens, the reason why people can't keep making music is because they ain't interested in none. They think they know every goddamn thing.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? And then they start, like, all that woe is me shit. Well, when you was 14, you wasn't rapping about, you know, the pubescent growth spurts. So why you have to get older and talk about prostate? Like, there are other things to talk about besides your doctor's appointment, bro. Like, I love you, boy. What the fuck are you talking about? Like, I love him. That's my man. He's super talented.
Yeah.
What the fuck is he talking about?
Yeah.
Like, you can do anything. You know what I'm saying? Like, he's one of the great, I'm talking about Andre's one of the greatest rappers ever. Like, I think he's amazing, but I disagree with that. Yeah. Like, with all due respect, and I ain't, you know, and this is viral now, but I'm just saying, with all due respect, I disagree with that because I think that he has it in him. You know what I'm saying? So me, I just want to show people that it's possible. I want to show you that it's possible, and the only way to show you is to do it.
Do you feel you get your credit in the game? Do you, like, in your standing? Do you care?
I mean, dude, I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I got 10 platinum albums, Grammys. I mean, yeah, I get my props, man. I got Kennedy Center honors. Yeah, I think I get my props. Listen, man, everybody's not going to be a fan of everybody. You know, that ain't my job.
I love that perspective.
You know what I'm saying? Like, that ain't my job. Yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, but yes, I feel completely respected.
I love that.
I feel beloved. I feel like the man.
I love that.
Mo,
you know what I mean?
On the topic of writing, I think it's very interesting because you're a comic, so you write alone. Do you have people who help you write?
It's weird because as a comic, I don't want to write alone because I feel like it can, like if I'm writing, my whole thing is I have to write to make someone laugh. Mm-hmm. So I've got to tap into someone's personality, what makes them laugh. And you got to remember, like, laughter, humor is subjective. So this is just my point of view of what I find funny. Do you know what I mean?
That was funny. I don't know.
Like, it's hard writing because I'm writing it like, this is funny. Right. But if I have outside influence as I'm writing it, someone might say, oh yeah, but that bit's funny. But I'm like, no, let's just go with this.
So Mo, I don't know if the comedic, chaotic landscape has made it across the pond, the whole stealing jokes thing, the Cat Williams, all that.
Yeah, we see it. Like, we see it at the same time, but again, it's like, for me, as a conversation to be in, like, I'm watching, these are my heroes, you know what I mean? Like, I'm watching, like, my favorite comics, and I'm like, I have no say in this. Don't get me wrong, it happens in comedy.
Oh, yeah.
But it's up to you what, like, you can either ring a man up and say, hey, listen, heard you done my joke, or, again, I'm one of those people, if I hear something that's a bit similar, I'm like, the people that watch my stuff know.
Like, of course, in art and sports, things get copied and changed and you make it your way. It's like I was telling people, I was talking to, not even about this topic, but just about like life. And it comes to football too. We were talking about hip hop and Jay-Z was saying, I'm from the tree of Coogee Rap. Like I come from Coogee Rap, there's a tree of rappers, LL and Coogee Rap, that was my, like Rakim was more like meaning how they did it, I loved it, I liked it, it influenced me, and I took it and made it my way. Sure. It's just like in football, there's coaching trees. Mm-hmm. Like, Belichick has a tree of guys. None of them have been particularly successful.
It's a difference between a tree and sampling, though. He like, Cat was talking about sampling. He was saying, like, and no, I'm not a comedian. Let me just say this. I don't want no beef with none of the comedians. That's the last thing I want. Okay, I just want to be clear about that. Don't jump on my ass, because I don't want no problem. I don't want problem.
They already gorged you about you licking your lips.
Yeah, well.
And you dropped your chaps.
Well, it is what it is.
They like that being chaps.
That ain't never going to stop.
They would get you a whole roast for that. And of course, there's so much material.
There's so much.
You're giving them all the material. You gave them so much material just now. They're run this back.
Yo, it's bananas.
Mike McDaniel is very successful in Miami. Mm-hmm. The shit he runs, the motion with the pitching, that's all from Kyle's. He might have added some tricks and he got Tyreek.
Yeah.
So he did some things different. But it's a version of y'all. I don't know if you watch the Dolphins, it's a version of y'all offense, right?
For sure. But what people don't really see is that Mike has been with Cal for, you know, when I got in the NFL, Mike was pushing paper and helping him draw the cards and stuff. And behind the scenes, like, he really was a real asset to Cal. Like, he learned a ton from Cal, and they bounced ideas off of each other, and but he was a real asset. They was an asset to each other.
For sure, yeah.
And I think we're kind of all derivative.
That's
of
my point.
Else.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
It's like we don't get Kobe and LeBron without Jordan. You know what I'm saying?
Course.
Like we see the influence, literally. The great artists are always switching up their style. Mm. So it's like the second someone picks up on what I'm doing, I'm gonna switch it up.
Mm.
And then
that's powerful
to
though. Don't rub. Don't like stay on that a minute. Mm-hmm. That's amazing.
Are you doing it on purpose? Meaning, because you feel like, are you tired of it or you just want something new?
I mean, honestly, I never want to repeat myself, you know, but also I'm growing as an artist. So it's like, I'm not going to do Queen and Slim again. I've done that. That's where I was at that time. Then the next thing after that was Beauty. It was a smaller film that wasn't theatrical, but was on Netflix. And it was different than that film, you know, and sort of like, or The Shy came first, but then 20s came after that. And so the hope is people see me evolving as an artist, because hopefully we're all evolving as people. Mm. So as you continue to move forward, different things inspire you. Like I think you might have been more intrigued by the actor world, being an actor. Like that was exciting. That was interesting for you, but also for us as audiences. And so, but then you go, okay, well, let me go back and give you some music too. You know what I'm saying? Like Will Smith did a similar thing. So it's about sometimes something is just more fascinating to an artist. Like even Andre 3000, like, yes, do we want him to do a rap album? Sure. But he's like, I'm on this flute game, y'all. Like this is my jam right now. I'm super into this. And so it's like, okay, cool, we'll take that. And
yeah,
so
I need him to spit, though.
Yeah.
I need him to spit, man.
I want to hear him spit,
fucking
too.
Flutes. Man, yeah. Come on, bro.
But y'all,
come
y'all
on,
go
bro.
Through phases.
Listen.
Like, I want to hear him spit, too.
He is...
I want to hear him spit.
Look, I'm going to be very... Because the comments going to be crazy. He's amazing, all right? His bars is all the way up. Yeah. I'm very
insane.
Clear.
Insane, yeah.
Not the flute, B. Yeah. Not the flute.
I want to hear him spit.
I like the album, though. I like the album.
I want to hear him spit.
That's very calming.
Listen. Not the fucking flute. Not the flute. Let's not lie to ourselves.
Like,
I don't want to hear him do the flute. You want to hear me do a violin? You might not want to hear me do shit. But do you want to hear me do a violin album?
Whatever you want to do.
LL got the violin shit.
Yo, Latifah did a jazz album.
I've been working on it for 7 years.
Latifah did a jazz album. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
listen. Drake's bars. I just want to hear. I want him to get with Big Boy. I want him to get with Big Boy. I want him to make an Outkast or do a solo album.
Well,
every time he does a
record,
one verse, it's enough material for an album. He's so gifted, right?
Right.
So it's like, come on, B, like, not the flu.
I want to hear words.
Like, we're not going to lie. Like, don't get, that man needs to know the truth. He needs to know the truth.
Yo, I like the album.
Nobody wants to. You like the album?
I did.
What's your favorite song?
I knew he was going to say that. I knew he was going to say
Here's the deal.
The one with the flute?
Come on, B. The titles of the songs are actually quite lit.
Great.
I don't want to. I don't want to misquote none of these bomb-ass titles.
I love him. He's supremely talented. I want to be clear about this. He's supremely talented. So, you know, I love him.
He's on the Mount Rushmore.
Not
He's
the flute,
dope.
Bro. Like
flute. Musical artists go through phases where sometimes they give us albums where we're like, okay, is this where you at?
No. We all make bad albums. Don't get me wrong. I've made bad albums, but I also have some crazy shit too. But I made bad shit or shit that people didn't respond to because that's where I was at.
But at the time, you thought it was good.
Not always.
Really? You put music out?
I'm a little bit of a weirdo though, B.
Really?
Yeah, because sometimes I make records in a vacuum just because it's for me, and then sometimes I make albums for the culture. I'm very different in that regard, so you can't really gauge my albums like that because I don't make all my records for the culture, and maybe that's what Andre was doing with the flute thing, mm-hmm. you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So I can understand it from that point of view. Right. He just expressed it differently. So I guess I can get it, but sometimes it's like the Prince records in the vault and you just put them out, and then sometimes it's the thing that you feel the culture, it can touch the culture. So they're very different approaches. They're very different approaches. You know what I'm saying? It's like,
What's this one gonna be, Al?
The difference is that.
No, what's this one that you're about to put out?
It's for the culture.
It's for the culture.
Oh, shit.
Okay. Yeah, no, it's for the culture.
I love it.
I haven't done an album for the culture in many years.
Is there gonna be a flute cameo?
It's all flutes. It's all motherfucking flutes.
Me and Dre, the duet, remixing the shit.
The flutes, I got the cello. I'm busting it down with the cello. It's crazy.
You gonna get a download from me. I'm interested.
Lynn, I wanted to ask you, aside from you being incredibly, incredibly talented, why has The Chi resonated the way it has? I mean, you guys just coming off a monster season as well.
Thank you. You know, it's so interesting. It's funny you talk about London. When I'm in London, people talk about The Chi to me. They talk about it. And it's such a beautiful feeling. And I think I really wanted to do a show about where I'm from, clearly. But I wanted to say something about who the people of Chicago are. I really wanted to humanize, particularly young Black men. That was super important to me because is there violence in Chicago? Yes, I can't ignore that and I would never deny that. But there's a lot of humanity in Chicago as well. And also I think people assume that people are born violent, mm-hmm. are born with this in their DNA to do illegal things. No, I think sometimes we may not be the product of our environment, but we can be the product of our circumstances. And so what I want to show is like, how do we show up in certain circumstances? And that to me taps into our humanity at home because you're wondering, what would I do if somebody was offering me a bunch of money and it would improve my life, but might make my safety questionable?
And as a writer, do you even have the seed of an idea on how The Chi ends?
Well, I've been thinking about it because I do want to land a plane.
Eventually, you have to. As consumers, you have to do it for us.
Yes.
And that's a very hard thing.
Exactly. Because the truth is, I'm also thinking about, and you've been on the TV shows, you know how it goes. I don't want to go out with a whimper. But I think what I want, I do think about legacy, you know, and I think about how do I want to walk off the field? How do I want to walk off the court? What's my last joke? You know what I'm saying?
So I
just really want the ending to resonate because we are in our sixth season, which is not our last season.
It's still so early. Let me tell you something. I'm just seriously, it's real early. You know, it's real early. Six seasons, I know it's a lot of material to write. Don't get me wrong. Yeah. I'm not underestimating the workload.
For sure.
I get it.
You know.
I'm clear. There's a million stories.
You're right.
You got this.
I think LL just volunteered for your writer's room. That's what I heard.
I know, and first of all, I appreciate that so much coming from you, such an icon, a legend, and that voice is in my head, trust me. But I also have another voice. You know that voice of like, when is it time? Know when to fold them, know when to get out, leave them wanting more.
That's fair.
Okay, here we go.
That's fear.
Is it fear or is it me want to make sure that I'm not walking out?
It's fear.
People are like, is that show still on? I want them to say, like, when does The Chi come back on?
Nah,
is The Chi still going?
I bet you any amount of money there was years ago when maybe Bron was like, man, you think I should, you know, because I go out on with a bang. Like, yo, nah. A lot of that is just fear.
you don't have to know what's going to happen. You know what I'm saying? You don't have to know what's going to happen to move forward. You take the steps. You take the steps. You go get it. Mm-hmm. You didn't know what was going to happen. You was a little boy running around with draws on, like being Superman, wanting to play in the NFL, watching TV. You didn't know what was going to happen. Like, you didn't know you was going to be halfway around the world doing jokes and, you know what I'm saying, coming from where you came from. Like, so I say that to say there's no limitation. We shouldn't limit ourselves. Don't put a period where there's a comma, you know, in your life. You know what I'm saying? Like, keep going and then figure it out. You will land the plane.
One of the main goals for each episode of The Shop is to share and learn from the unique experiences of all our guests as we curate conversations with those who are shaping culture. What I've learned is that through the journey, you know, all the hard work, the hustle, and the consistency, it's always important to celebrate your wins. So do it in style and raise a glass to toast the unforgettable moments that continue to make us who we are. Toast to your wins with a Grey Goose Martini cocktail. Check out greygoose.com for smooth-tasting recipes. And remember, sip responsibly. The Shop podcast is presented by Grey Goose Vodka.
One of the things I find fascinating about people in the public eye, you guys, is to the audience, you're superhuman, right? I think football players are the greatest example of that. Sure. It's like, how's he out with turf toe or whatever? Look, he gets paid how much and blah, 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 blah,
he
blah.
He played through it.
Right? Exactly, right? And I think sometimes, you know, athletes specifically don't get that benefit of the doubt that you deal with real life shit, right? You went through a real life scare, you know, with the cancer scare, and still have football on your mind. How'd you deal with that? What was your process?
Do you guys know this story? You should tell the story a little bit, Trent.
Yeah, I mean, I might as well tell. Now, I mean, really, you know, it's funny, you never really know how tough you are till you gotta be. You know what I'm saying? Or how strong you are till you ain't got a choice but to be strong, and that's the only option. So for me, just going through the cancer scare, like you said, I did feel somewhat invincible. I was like 7 straight Pro Bowls. You know, I just felt like life was good. You know, me and my boys, we on vacation. You know what I'm saying? Like, get the call, and it started to kind of snowball from there. You know, get a call from a doc, and he's like, you know, I had this mask on my, you know, right inside my hairline, and I used to have to wear my hair kind of high just to hide it, you know, and I was told, you know, from the team doctors that it was a cyst and not to worry about it, so I didn't worry about it and just dealt with it. You know, it wasn't painful or nothing. But eventually, I'm like, hey, I've been looking at this for like 5 years now. I just want it gone, you know what I'm saying?
Of course.
Every time I go in there, it was never a good time because it was right where my hairline is, my helmet got to be. So you get stitches right there, you can't play for at least a week. So I could never do it during the season. Then, you know, off season, I'm out training, so I ain't trying to take a break from that either. So, you know, it was a bit of both of us just kind of like, they was telling me something that I really kind of wanted to hear, that it wasn't nothing. So, you know, fast forward 5 years, I'm finally like, hey, I'm going to take, you know, right after this game, I'm healthy, I ain't got nothing, no rehab. I'm going to go last game of the season. After that, I want to go get this cut off. And so I went and did that. And the doctor that did it was questioning me about it. I'm like, man, I was told it was a cyst. He was like, man, I don't think this no cyst. I'm like, bro, it's a cyst. Just cut it off. I'm trying to go. Like, I got to fight the catch, X, Y, and Z. So he's like, all right, you know. And I remember it being really painful, and it wasn't supposed to be because I was really numbed up. You know, so then that kind of like was a red flag a little bit, but I ain't worried about it. Got it cut out. We went on our trip. I get a call from the doc. He had a real heavy Indian accent, so he was speaking kind of frantic, and I didn't really understand him. And really, I got like that eerie feeling in my stomach. I'm like, this sounds kind of important, and I really just didn't even want to deal with what it could be. So I didn't even listen to the rest of the voicemail. I'm like, I'm gonna just try to enjoy my time. Obviously, when I get back, the team is calling, hey, we need to go back in. They said it didn't look normal, X, Y, and Z. So I'm like, all right. Start getting a little worried. So they're like, we're gonna make you a doctor's appointment. By this time, I'm at the Pro Bowl, right? I'm in Orlando with the kids, Disney World, you know. My mom, she's an LVN, so she's a nurse now. So I tell her about it, and she'll worry, so I really didn't want to tell her. So I tell her, and she like, that's interesting. Like, when is the doctor's appointment? I'm like, it's Wednesday. She's like, what kind of doctor are you going to? So I never even thought to even think about it. So I went in my room and I Googled it and it said oncologist. And I'm like,
yeah.
Oh shit. So like I just it's probably 3 o'clock in the evening. I just laid in the bed, kind of just confused. Like, damn, I didn't know what was coming next, you know, but I know it's getting serious. Cause I can hear it in everybody's voice. So, you know, I just kind of start bracing for it. Next week come, we in the doctor's office. It's like 10 doctors in there, you know.
Who went with you, your mom?
My mom, yeah, just me and my mom. And, you know, so they kind of crowd around. They like, we're pretty sure you know why you're here. I'm like, I have no fucking clue why I'm here. So, you know,
you
just put it on me.
You never revisited the voice message?
No, I didn't. I never even thought to, honestly. Uh-huh. But I'm just like, look, doc, just put it on me, man. What's going on? And like, I see this pretty, you know, it's a lot of people in here. And it's like, well, you got this rare form of cancer that, you know, it's like, he said it's like 5%, like 1 in 5 million chance of getting this particular cancer, or something like that. It was like really rare. So really, honestly, I couldn't even hear nothing. As soon as he said cancer, that, it was like, yeah, I'm like, what the fuck?
I just got a chill hearing that.
So. Yeah, yeah. So even every time I hear the word cancer, it's like, you know, it bring that back. But so from there, they like, hey, so how long has this been there? And I'm like, I look at the team doc because he was in there. And I'm like, I mean,
and it's the same team doctor that's been there for 5 years.
Yeah. So I'm like, oh, you didn't tell him. And he just kind of like, you know, kind of looked down a little bit. So I'm like, it's been like 5 years. And they just like, oh, shit. You know, everybody had spread. That oh, shit look. So they like, oh, this might be bigger than what we thought. We got to put a board of doctors together. So it took them like 2 days to put all these doctors to come together because, you know, it's been there so long, they're scared how far it went.
And Trent, at that moment, are you even thinking football? You're thinking life? Like, what's...
At that moment, no, I wasn't thinking football at that moment. But I didn't think that it was... I didn't think my life was in danger. You know what I'm saying? Like, but I wasn't thinking football. I was just thinking more like my kids and stuff, you know? So when they said put a board of doctors together, that was kind of very alarming to me. So, you know, fast forward about a week, they doing all this preparation and stuff. Mind you, I'm going to the doctor like maybe once every 2 days, different appointment. They cutting a piece of my, like literally cutting a piece out every time I go, you know what I'm saying? And so I'm about to get it, you know, taken out. They think that they got the root of it, you know, no big deal. So the surgery is Friday. On Thursday, they like, hey, let's go get an MRI so we can have our real plan in place and know how we supposed to do this and this and that. So we do the MRI. That day, no, it was Wednesday. That Thursday, they called me, and it's like 3 o'clock. And mind you, I'm in Northern Virginia, which is like 45 minutes from D.C., so it's not with traffic like an hour. So he like, man, I need you to come in the office. I'm like, office? It's like 3 o'clock. By the time I get there, it should be closed. He like, listen, I don't care what time you get here, I'm going to be here. And that like basically like made me get butterflies. I'm like, damn, that don't sound good, you know? So my mom, she was watching the kids, and I was very conscious about taking them with me to the doctors because at that time my oldest was been able to read, and you know, I ain't want her seeing and just carrying that burden with her at school every day. So before I knew how in-depth it was, you know what I'm saying? So I go and I get in the office and it's literally just the doctor and the nurse there, everybody gone. I'm walking, it's dark, you know? And I could tell the nurse, she didn't really like want to make eye contact. So I'm noticing all this stuff while I'm coming in there. So I'm really, you know, I'm like a ball of nerves. And then I'm waiting on the doc. He finally come. He walk in, and as soon as he start talking, the nurse, her lips start shaking and shit. Like, she's about to start tearing up. Wow. I'm like, damn, man. He just go on like, you know, I know you love football. And, you know, it just, I'm like, look, bro, just... Tell me what's going on. Yeah, he like, listen, man, you need to not worry about football. You just need to get close to your daughters and, like, the people you love the most, because, you know, it don't look like it's not looking that good. So I'm like,
wow.
What the fuck changed?
What? I was like, damn, I couldn't even look at it. I'm literally just like staring off into space because I'm trying to process what he just told me. I'm a 30-year-old man. I feel healthy as possible. He just told me I don't got that long to live. So,
what'd he say, like?
He said, get your affairs in order. Oof. That's what he told me. That was word for word.
Oof.
He's like, you gotta get your affairs in order. I'm like, and instantly, I didn't even think about dying, honestly. I didn't even, like, I knew that would come. That's coming naturally anyway. But I just started thinking, you know, I got all girls. You know what I'm saying? At that time, I had two daughters. And I was just thinking, like, damn, I want to walk them down the aisle. I want to send them off to college. I want to see them graduate. I'm like, damn, I don't think I'm going to make it that long, you know, especially what he's saying. So, you know, really, I don't even know how I got home. Like, I drove an hour to the house, and I swear, I just remember parking the car, and I'm like, damn, I don't even know where my mind was in autopilot. Like, it was just...
Of course.
It was like an out-of-body experience. And then after that, that's when everything started to ramp up. They flew me to Chicago.
Oh, wow.
Down in Northwestern. And they went and they was like, they did a scan. They was like, all right, so they thought that the tumor, because the tumor sat here. So they, and it looked like from the MRI that it had metastasized through to my brain, to my skull and stuff. So in their mind, they're like, it's pretty much over once that happened. So go to Chicago. Luckily, they have like this 3D imaging and they could see cancer cells. And they said it hasn't, the tumor was attached to my skull, which was the scary part because it had been there so long that this tumor has roots. It's not like a mass, like, right? It's like tentacles, like an octopus. So, you know, that shit was like spreading. So it looked on the surface, it looked like a small, like, you know, what would be bigger, a little bigger than a mosquito bite. But, you know, when you look at the surgery picture, it was like this big, you know what I'm saying? I lost like 30% of my scalp, mm-hmm. You know, so.
Damn.
But like you said, when they looked at it, they saw my mom was like, look, y'all done been sending them too many doctors. We getting this. So I want them to go to MD Anderson, which is like number one. Like, we want to go there. So and call MD Anderson, they're like, fast we can get you in, it's like 10 days. And they're like, well, we ain't got 10 days. It could metastasize tomorrow. You could take 3 days, but we don't know. We really don't have, you can't take that chance. So I flew to Houston, they couldn't get me in. I had to shave my head that night, flew back, and then that's when I underwent three surgeries.
Where you had the surgeries at?
In Chicago.
At Northwestern?
Yeah. Northwestern.
Wow.
Yeah.
Damn, man, that's amazing.
Glad you're here, brother.
Oh, yeah, no, I'm blessed,
how
bro.
Did you, so, because I know this, so now you got to go back to Washington and look at that same trainer who let that thing, kept telling you it was nothing.
Yeah.
How do you walk back in there and look at it?
I honestly.
And we've seen you. We've seen you push around a lot of guys and punch with your shirt. So.
But no, honestly, man. You know, I'm a realist anyway. I understand the business. Like, it was a...
He just wants y'all on the field, man.
Yeah, right. And again, it was a rare form of cancer. It was a cancer that 80% of cancer docs don't even see, you know? So there's no way this team doc who's looking at knees and ankles and, you know, you got the flu or whatever, there's no way he could make an eyesight determination on what that was, you know what I'm saying? So... honestly, I don't think it benefited me by holding a grudge against him. Mm-hmm. You know, I was more so focused on the blessing. Like, shit, I'm here. Like, I can go hold my kids at night. Like, I'm walking through these hallways at this hospital, and you see people wheeling their parents around, or parents wheeling their kids around, and you know that the end is near. You know, and I just got this great prognosis that, you know, I got the big surgery, but I'll be fine. Like, my kids gonna have me around. And like, I kind of had this survivor's remorse a little bit. I felt guilty. Like, I've had this, you know, I've been privileged to be in this position, to be able to live my dream. And then I go through this cancer battle and I get by on like basically what would've been a 1% chance of it not getting through to my brain. So it's like, what did I do to be so lucky or deserve this, you know what I'm saying? So I had to deal with that, but, you know, just being able to to take advantage of being able to have my family around, my kids around, like, that helped me get back in the mind, just saying, hey, I went through an obstacle. I was blessed to get over it. You know what I'm saying? Sure. Not stop looking in the rearview mirror, like, you know.
It changed how you live. And
yeah, it changed me 100%. Like, it was one of the worst things you can imagine going through, but it's probably the best thing that ever happened to me.
Wow.
Because it made me appreciate not only my career, but it made me appreciate life. You know, and when you're young and, you know, you got a lot, you take shit for granted. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're untouchable in a sense.
Wow. Mm.
But how does it affect you now, what you dealt with now, like any game, but specifically the Super Bowl, you lose it. Does it have an effect on how you deal with losing and going forward from that?
You know, that's the biggest loss you can take, you know, but at the end of the day, you look at it for what it is. Like I said, I'm a realist. Like, we two teams left out of 32 teams, you two teams fighting for that one trophy. Like, I mean, yeah, it sucks, but you got to look back and say, at the end of the day, it was a successful season, you know. Like, I used to think, shit, I'll just get me to the Super Bowl. I don't care if we win or lose. I just want to feel that atmosphere. Yeah. Like, it was, I had never won a playoff game in the first 10 years of my career. Wow, so to even see, think about the Super Bowl NFC Championship, I'm like, I just want to feel it. I done put so much into this game. You know, I done sacrificed so much. Okay. I haven't felt the pinnacle yet, you know, and I just, you know, I wanted to be there. I just wanted to experience it. And then when you get there, you understand it's just another football game. Now you want to win that game as bad as ever. Now me getting there wasn't really good enough at the time. You know what I'm saying? So, you know, I think I take it in stride, man. Like, I done had obstacles, and I think that's just another one of them, man.
You know, it's one beautiful part of your story is your mother's love, man.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, for sure.
Like, a mother's love is something else.
Yeah, nah.
Like, your mother loved you. Like, I could feel the love.
I can feel
when you was talking about it, I could feel your mom's love you.
But did you tell her that's the only part? When you left the house that day and they called you and the nurse was quivering and your mom was watching the kids, did you tell her you had got that car or did you just leave?
Nah, I just left.
So she didn't know what you was going to do?
She didn't know. She didn't know. When I got home, like I said, she was there in the house. And that was the hardest part about coming home, because we had been told everything was going to be okay. And now I got to come tell my mom that, hey, they just told me that I don't got long to live. And, like, having to call my dad and, like, tell him that over the phone, that was tough. Really telling everybody, that was pretty tough. Like, you know, I didn't tell a lot of people, but, you know, my really, really close circle, I had to express, because it was a lot to hold, you know what I'm saying?
For sure. For sure. That's a thing.
Pivoting a little bit, we talked Super Bowl. There was a lot made of the overtime thing. The rules. Did you personally know of the rule? That there was some confusion, it seemed. The team didn't know. What's your take on it?
Yeah.
Your experience, I should say.
I personally knew because of, you know, it was a deal the year before with Josh Allen and that whole deal. So, to be real with you, bro, I ain't gonna lie. After that game, I hadn't logged in to Instagram, Twitter, nothing. I've been basically...
You checked out.
Yeah, I checked out. I just like, shit, I just need to...
Good for you.
You know, like, we was out there. We was exposed. You just took your worst loss in front of everybody. Like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, you got pride. We prideful. So I just had to take a break, take a step back, just make sure I'm good.
But Lena, before we get you out of here, I know you got to run. Cannabis brand. Talk a little bit about that. That's very dope to hear.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, we definitely like to show on all of our shows people smoking weed. Like, it's a piece of our culture that I'm not afraid to show and also to take shame away from that as well. And so my first strain is called First Draft, which is also a play on, you know.
Sativa.
Yeah, it's a sativa, but it's also a hybrid. You know what I mean? So it keeps the body calm, but the brain working. And we want to do a play on the fact that I am a writer. So the first time you write the script, it's the first draft. It's been an exciting journey. And I also look forward to it being legal everywhere. I think we'll get there eventually. But it's just really nice to see how far that journey has come as well. You talk about journeys. I mean, think about where we were 10 years ago and to where we are now and where we're going. So I just think it's important for us to get involved in that business and to have fun with it.
Love that.
Yeah.
Lena, we're going to let Lena go.
I got to go right.
You're going to run.
Go right.
Thanks, man. Appreciate y'all.
All right.
Y'all have a good conversation. Later.
Do you drink when you're on stage?
No, I make
you
it happen.
You go on stage totally sober.
Yeah, I like to be sober. It makes me more fresh, more sharp. It's weird because I've done shows before and I've had a drink like beforehand, and sometimes they've been my best shows. But I don't want that to feel like that was what made me feel like I had a good show.
But it makes you more loose, right?
It does, but then the habit is like, you can be too loose with the tongue. Sure. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. And like, I always say this as a comic. I was like, as much as crowd work is fun and you get to, you know, you can make some material out of someone in the audience, you also remember that at the end of the show, there's nothing stopping that person coming up to you and said, let me talk to you for a second.
Let me holler at you, man.
Yeah, that's happened before, man.
Has that happened to you?
Yeah, that's happened before, man.
In London?
It happened in London
once.
What
happened? Tell us
about it. So basically, I used to have this part of the show where I used to say, listen, and the audience would be standing there. I said, listen, before I start the show, I'm not going to make fun of anyone in the audience. So I would point out someone. I said, let's say, for example, your name is Clarissa, yeah? And I say, chlamydia. Yeah, you all got the joke, yeah? So everyone got the joke that, like, I'm going to say, oh, chlamydia, your name, but it's Clarissa. So that's the joke. Audience laughs. I'm carrying on with the show. I see her boyfriend. He's not laughing at nothing.
The whole show. You eyeing him the whole show.
The show's
he's probably
going well.
Burning like a mug.
I'll never forget it. The whole show's going well. She's laughing, but he's just like this throughout the whole show. Now, as a comic, when you're on stage, you know when someone's laughing. You're like, this person's really
Teddy,
not laughing.
Teddy, what's up, bro? Come on in, bro. Come on in, bro. What's up, bro? Yeah, what's Teddy, up? You're jumping in at a great
time.
Am I here? Yes, you're right there.
Okay.
Go ahead. So finish the story, so go ahead.
Yeah, so I've done the show. The show was fine. Show had finished now. And I remember the show finishing. And, you know, you get paid after your show. This is like cash in hand days when I was still doing the open mic circuit. This guy has paid me and I can still see this guy waiting around like this. And I didn't, you just know, let me just leave. There's no reason for me to talk to him. 2 weeks later, I promise you not, I'd done this show. I'll never forget, the show had this L-shaped room. And there's one set of people here, they're eating food and they're not really laughing. But the other set, they don't have the food option. So they're just normal comedy goes and they're laughing. But I can notice as I'm performing that there's someone not laughing in this section where everyone don't have food. So I'm like, that guy looks familiar, man. He looks so familiar. And it's the same guy who was at the show previously. And again, I'm just like, again, my mind is rattled because I'm like, these are ain't laughing, they're eating food, but these are having a fun time. But this particular guy ain't laughing. So I've left the show and you're in between these double doors and I walk through the door and he comes in. I look at him, he looked at me and I'm like, hey, what's up? And he's like, no, fuck that.
Fuck that, what's up, shit?
Pleasantries.
No, fuck that. Yeah. Hilarious.
So
now, no. So fuck all that.
So I'm trying to do the whole, oh, you was at the show. He's like, listen, I never forget this. He goes, listen, I seen you at the show 2 weeks ago and you disrespected my girlfriend. And I'm trying to now explain. I said, no. The joke is, no. Fuck that. Yeah. My heart is beating because it's never happened to me before. Right? My heart is beating. And he goes, listen, if you ever disrespect my girlfriend like that ever again, I'm going to cave in your face, right? So then, again, I'm trying to explain. I'm like, no, but what is? He goes, listen, fuck the explanations. And I'll never forget this. He goes, listen, I think you're hilarious. Keep doing what you're doing. And good luck with the rest of your career. And I left out the door. And I was in this weird situation where I was like, that's the weirdest thing that's ever happened to me. But at the same time, I'm not going to make anyone the butt of my jokes ever again.
So you stopped.
Because he was so calm. And I always say, the scariest man is the calmest man. But comedy's like that. And you got to remember as well, in the black community, the way we go out to experience a comedy show is different. I've always found, because I've done different audiences. I've done white audiences. I've done, you know, audiences that you can tell they're very wealthy. Do you know what I mean? But you can tell sometimes you do a show that's in the hood. I remember doing a show once. I see this guy sitting in front. I said, what's going on, my guy? I see you. Big silver chain. This guy humbled me. He's like, big man, do the jokes. And again, I was frightened for my life.
I started that's talking a good about,
laugh. Oh, listen, do the jokes.
Stick to the jokes, man.
Listen, I started talking about the weather for no reason. But you learn these things, man. In comedy, you learn, man. That's why I always say, understand the environment that you're in. Do you know what I mean?
Teddy, he talked about funny is funny. Like, if you just make people laugh. When you first came out, the first thing I seen you covering Marvin Gaye, right? So now it was like so interesting to me to see you covering who I think the greatest voice ever. Marvin Gaye is the greatest voice ever. And to black people, Marvin Gaye is like, there's like Jesus and Marvin Gaye. Like, he made What's Going On. He made Sexual Healing. He's the only artist who could do both. But were you all worried about black people accepting you singing soul and covering Marvin Gaye?
Absolutely. I will always say that, but my biggest thing is it's like, that's not for me to take or tell this story that's not mine. Or I'm here to pay homage to the greatest that's ever done it.
And when you create, do you even think about genres of music, are you just like, this is how I feel? Meaning, do you think, because your music is soulful, sometimes it's a little rock, sometimes a little
pop,
whatever,
country.
Do you think about that, or are you like, I'm just making the songs that I like?
I found that in my time of trying to make music, I find that I've always kind of gotten blocked or blocked the creative act when I've been like, oh, this is too rock, or this is too soul, or this is too much of this. I try now just to do whatever feels like it's asking for, and get out of the way of the creative act happening. I think there's something in the air that's just falling down when you're in a room writing, and you just get the hell out of the way and let it happen.
Do you think genres even matter anymore?
I don't think so, because what I was so fortunate with my song Lose Control that hit that point was
amazing record.
It was working. Thank you, man. It was working on country stations, and it was working on pop stations and R&B and rhythmic stations too, and rock stations. I think a good song still works, and people are hungry for tunes, man.
Yes. And the idea of being discovered on social, were you going for that? Or were you just doing this thing I love? Were you like, I want to be discovered, so I'm going to put these things out?
Well, I never thought that covers would be the thing. It just truly started. So 2019, June 25th, it was 10 years that Michael Jackson had passed away, and I just wanted to put a cover up of Rock With You on to just kind of pay homage to that and say, man, salute to the GOAT, And we woke up the next day and it had stupid amount. I think it had 10,000 views on it. And we were like, bro, we're getting fucking shit out tonight. 10,000 views. Absolutely. Fuck yeah, boys, we made it, And but I think once it finally started getting to the 500,000 mark, it was just I found that was the funny thing that has worked for me because of social media, I think, is the gimmick of that I sound this way, but I look this way, and it kind of helped a lot. But I think when people first saw a million views on it and see me in a camo t-shirt with a bunch of face tattoos singing Rock With You, I think people were like, either this is actually good or this is going to be fucking hilarious.
Hilarious, exactly.
And it ended up being both for me. Yes. So I think I'm just, happy for the fucking gimmick. I'm working the gimmick, baby. What I mean?
For sure. You were discovered on social too, right?
Yeah, man. Yeah, social media is where I am today, really. I guess it's probably the same as you. When you find the thing that goes viral, you're like, this, I didn't mean for this to happen, but it's happened, and then someone shares it, and then it might be, a famous person shares it, and then again, and then you just see this count of followers going up. But it's almost like the great thing is it's amazing for your career because you're getting all these new followers, but you don't have any money. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. So I'm still in retail.
You had blown up and were still working.
Retail. So Jermaine was the first retail, and then Levi was the last place I was at. So my numbers are going up. People are sharing my stuff. Drake started following me and stuff. You got to remember, from being South London, my friends lost their mind. My friends are like, you made it now, Mm-hmm. I'm like, bro, it's just a follower. But I think the beautiful thing is with social media, it's a heightened reality.
For sure.
Do you know what I mean? So people assuming that I've got money, or they're like, oh, Drake follows you now. You guys must DM each other. I'm like, no, why would I wouldn't do that. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? I don't want it to unfollow.
I'm trying to keep it.
Yeah, I don't want that. But then I needed to turn my what was happening into saying to people, look, I'm a stand-up comic. This is what I do. As much as people like the videos and it's all cool, this is what I'm actually good at doing. And it's the same thing you're saying, bro, people, I think what I found is people had seen the videos and they're like, are you funny though? Because the videos are funny. It's a minute of comedy. It's like fast food. But it's almost like, can you make a real mac and cheese from start?
Yeah. And Mo, does that process change? You're on tour, right?
Are
you preparing differently for this tour you're on?
I think for tour show, I have to be more sharp. I think if I'm just doing 10, 20 minutes at the club, I can mess around and have fun. But I know if people have paid good money on a Saturday, women get their hair done and their nails done, the man them got a trim, I know I've got to put on the best show, because you're you bring your woman out, you got a babysitter. No one wants to see me messing around. So I think when you're on tour, it's even more important, especially coming over here, because people are like, you've made the trip over here. I finally got to see you. And what I've realized here, people, you guys travel. like meeting people that come from Florida, Arizona, that have flown in. So I need to put on the best show possible now. Do you know what I mean? I can't really mess around, but that's what we do with the work in progress is, you know, I do a work in progress show to iron out and make sure the show is pinpoint. Because the minute when people come to something that they paid good money for and they say, oh, it's a shame, we waited 2 years for this and it wasn't, you was just on stage asking, you know, who's in the house? Do you know what I mean? It's like, I don't want that feeling, do you know what I mean?
You know, as we've been touring since the pandemic is over and we're starting from 2,000s and going to 3,000s, it's going, you have to do every step of that way to get those asses into those seats and really like, the touring business now is so different than what the music business is, and they're two separate entities altogether. And I see so many kids that'll have a hit or a smash on TikTok, and when they're having a number one record, they're trying to sell a tour, and they're going out and they can't sell 300 tickets, you know? And, and they got a number one record. Or worse, they skip all these steps and never do the 300 caps and the 500s. They never do that. And then next thing you know, they got the number one hit right now and they're doing these arenas. And then 2 years later, they can't sell a fucking ticket to save their lives.
You used to be a football player.
Yeah.
And then there was a teacher who told you go do music.
Yeah.
Is that because they knew you weren't going to be as big as Trent?
Well, yeah. I'm 5'7", my dog. Yeah, I've been worn my goddamn platforms in here. Because I try to look like a 5'9" snagging these bad boys. Though, so.
Do you still speak to that teacher, Teddy?
Yeah, actually, man, what's even crazier, that we played in Birmingham, Alabama like a week or two ago, and this teacher I had in fourth grade, Miss Berry, so she was like a sergeant in the military, and she used to tell us after class, you know, like after recess, if everybody shut the fuck up and just does their workbook, she put in greatest hits of Al Green for us. And
in fourth grade?
In fourth grade. We're all like 8 or 9 years old.
That's in Georgia. Not in Ohio. We did not get out.
Well, this is the first time I ever heard soul music.
The teacher said, shut the fuck up?
Well, she didn't say that. I'm paraphrasing.
Oh, okay.
Fourth grade, she played Al Green.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
And what's
that's
crazy, awesome. Dude, these nine-year-olds are all in here like they know about heartbreak and shit. Just like, oh, yeah. Like, everybody was just crying. I remember going home to my dad. I was like, dude, I heard this song, Dad. It's like, and I the first time I heard that, I'm so tired of being alone. I was like, fuck, Dad, what is this? I didn't say fuck either then. But you know, I was just like, Dad, you know, what is this? I had never heard soul music before. I grew up, my mom's side was like, you know, Pentecostal pastor. So it was, you know, like, and not the good kind of gospel. Like,
yes, I know what you mean.
Like,
yes.
Like, you know, fucking Jesus culture, you know what I mean? Like,
of course, yeah.
So, I mean, when I first heard that, I was like, Dad, you know, he put me on a Keith Sweat after that, Marvin Gaye and all sorts of cool shit. And I was like, yo, this is music right here. This is the shit. Fucking,
that's fourth grade Al Green. That's the type of class I want my kids to get.
Yeah, man.
For sure.
And so she came to the show not too long ago because I talked to her. I talk about her all the time in interviews and stuff. I'm like, where is she now? What is she doing now? You know, is she still alive? Is she like, is she ever hear me talking about her? And she's standing in the front row and one of these people had Miss Berry's here, you know? And
oh,
I brought her back and got to see her and we took a picture and, you know, gave her my number. And it was cool because you never know what you're doing to kids, you know? Like, you never know.
For sure.
Like,
you never know what they're going to turn into.
Yeah, it's crazy.
So, shout out to Miss Berry. With that, we're a wrap, fellas. Thank you, guys.
You're listening to The Shot Podcast, presented by Grey Goose Vodka. Whether it's a dinner party for 10 or a small kickback, you know the vibes will always be right if you're surrounded by your favorite people. And great company pairs best with a great cocktail. So make it a Grey Goose Martini cocktail. Impress your guests in style with an espresso martini or the always effortless classic martini with a lemon twist. No matter what you decide, everyone can appreciate the smooth, delicate taste that only a Grey Goose vodka martini can provide. For more info on how to craft a vodka-based cocktail, visit greygoose.com and remember to always sip responsibly. Sip responsibly. www.responsibledrinking.org. 2024, Grey Goose. Its trade dress and the geese device are trademarks. Imported by Grey Goose Importing Company, Coral Gables, Florida. Vodka, 40% alcohol by volume, distilled from French wheat.